Beneath the opulent Victorian mansion that once symbolized America's brewing empire lies a network of tunnels locals call the Gates of Hell. The Lemp family first used these limestone passages for cooling and storing their beer. But over time, the halls became linked to much darker associations. The underground gates, the string of family tragedies within the mansion, and the persistent legend of a hidden child in the attic form the core of what makes this place so unsettling. Visitors and investigators continue to report chilling encounters at these depths, experiences that keep alive the mansion's haunted reputation. To understand how such a grand estate became tied to despair and folklore, we need to return to the very beginning, when one immigrant's simple recipe started building a fortune that would shape an empire. In the early 19th century, the man behind this empire was not yet a brewer, but a newcomer making his way in St. Louis. Adam Lemp, a German immigrant who arrived in 1838, began with little more than a recipe carried from his homeland and a determination to introduce something new to American drinkers. At a time when English-style ales dominated the market, dark, heavy, and often overwhelming, he offered lager beer, a brighter and smoother option that promised not just refreshment but difference. Lemp's entry point was a small grocery store where he sold his lager beside everyday provisions. Many locals were skeptical, and competitors dismissed his focus on cold fermentation as unworkable. Lagers needed consistent cool temperatures to ferment properly, and Missouri's hot summers made that nearly impossible. While other breweries halted production when the weather turned warm, Lemp sought an answer that would allow him to brew all year. That answer lay deep beneath St. Louis. The city sat atop an extensive network of natural limestone caves that held a constant cool temperature throughout the seasons. Lemp seized the opportunity, converting these passages into storage chambers where his lager could age slowly and consistently, a practical refrigeration workaround long before mechanical systems became widespread. His competitors had no comparable solution, and the difference showed in both quality and reliability. Customers quickly noticed, and the crisp taste of his lager began to spread from local taverns to a growing circle of drinkers up and down the Mississippi. The grocery store soon became far too small for his ambitions. With the success of his brewing operation, Lemp shifted his focus fully toward beer production, building what came to be called the Western Brewery. Within a few decades, the business expanded into one of the largest breweries in St. Louis, and eventually, one of the most important lager producers outside New York. The strategic use of the caves gave the brewery a dependable edge over rivals and ensured that the Lemp name would be tied to innovation in American brewing. As the profits mounted, the family's influence grew beyond the brewery itself. The wealth generated from beer would allow the Lemps to shape not just the commercial heart of St. Louis, but also their own private world, a home that would come to reflect both grandeur and secrecy. It was in this house, constructed from the fortune Adam built, that the next chapter of the story would take hold. The brewing fortune soon rose above ground in the form of a mansion unlike anything St. Louis had seen before. Known as the Lemp Mansion, it expanded into a 33-room Victorian structure that announced the family's wealth to the world. Craftsmen filled its halls with carved mahogany and oak woodwork, while marble mantels anchored the fireplaces and ceilings glowed with hand-painted designs. Even everyday details spoke of luxury, from imported fixtures to richly patterned floors, creating a setting where no visitor could mistake the family's prosperity. Modern comforts, central heating, indoor plumbing, and gas lighting made the mansion not just ornate but technologically advanced for its time. Below this surface display, an equally striking world developed. The family extended the natural limestone caves beneath St. Louis into a series of storage chambers and tunneled passages, including one that linked the mansion directly to the brewery. These subterranean corridors allowed family and staff to pass between the two sites without braving the city streets, while the cool stone vaults provided essential storage for lager before mechanical refrigeration was possible. In time, the caves began to reflect more than practical utility. Certain chambers were adapted for recreation as the Lemps blended their business empire with leisure. Visitors might step into an underground theater complete with a stage, or drift past a private bowling alley echoing beneath the earth. Most remarkable was a swimming pool installed below ground, its water heated by steam lines piped directly from the brewery's operations. What had started as a system built purely for production became a peculiar extension of the family's lavish way of life. This mixture of opulence and industry, grand rooms above ground paired with tunnels and chambers below, captured the essence of what the Lemps had built. The mansion testified to their social standing, while the subterranean network symbolized the ingenuity that made such wealth possible. Yet the contrast between glittering surface life and shadowed underground passages added an eerie dimension that lingered long after their heyday. While the mansion stood as the most visible sign of their rising power, it was only one piece of a vast enterprise. The same vision that shaped ornate halls and subterranean theaters was also pushing their brewery beyond local success. By the height of their influence, the Lemp family was no longer just building houses or tunnels. They were forging an empire that would place their name alongside America's industrial dynasties. By the final decades of the 19th century, the Lemp Brewery had reached a scale that few American brewers could rival. Under William J. Lemp's leadership, the company built an industrial complex in St. Louis that not only dominated several city blocks but also shipped beer far beyond the Midwest. With the aid of the expanding railroad system, the Lemps were among the first to use refrigerated rail cars in the later 1800s, allowing their lager to travel safely from the Mississippi River to both coasts. This breakthrough gave them true national reach at a time when most brewers remained locked into regional markets. To secure that growth, the Lemps extended control into multiple parts of the supply chain. They did not stop at brewing, but reached into grain sourcing, bottling, storage, and distribution. Such vertical integration was unusual for the time, and it made their enterprise vastly more stable than many smaller competitors. The Falstaff label, established under their leadership, became one of the better-known national beer names, helping the company's identity spread far beyond St. Louis. Their workforce of hundreds sustained round-the-clock production, filling a network of warehouses and plants that made the family's name inseparable from the city's industrial image. Technology reinforced their reach. The brewery introduced automated bottling lines that filled, capped, and labeled thousands of bottles each day, turning beer into something families could purchase and enjoy at home rather than only in saloons. Combined with refrigerated shipping, this innovation allowed the company to send uniform quality lager across long distances without loss of taste or freshness. These advances reshaped American drinking habits and helped entrench lager as the new national standard. The fortune created by this enterprise placed the Lemps among the wealthy of the Gilded Age. Their mansion became a venue for banquets, political gatherings, and visits from high-profile guests, with private access to the brewery offered through the connecting tunnels. Here, prosperity was displayed not only through architecture and entertaining, but also through their influence in St. Louis life. Workers at the brewery benefited as well, enjoying rare stability for the era. The family provided housing, medical support, and social amenities, a style of paternalistic management that bound employees to the company with unusual loyalty. Despite their outward success, the empire's management remained tightly bound to family oversight. The Lemps personally approved recipes, monitored fermentation in the caves, and steered every step of operation. While this ensured consistency, it also left the business dependent on a small circle of decision makers. That concentration of authority was a quiet vulnerability, one that would soon matter when sudden loss disrupted the family's ambitions and stability. The first blow to the Lemp dynasty came in 1901, when Frederick Lemp, the son carefully prepared to inherit the brewery, died suddenly at the age of 28. As operations manager, Frederick had been central to the company's rhythm, combining technical insight with the authority to guide its workforce. His loss left no clear successor, and it struck at the moment when brewing was becoming more competitive, with new rivals rising and consumer tastes evolving. For William J. Lemp Sr., this loss proved impossible to bear. The man, once known for his sharp instincts and constant presence within the brewery, began to withdraw from the world. Once engaged in every decision, he ceased his daily oversight of the business, leaving responsibilities to other family members who lacked Frederick's training and vision. The elegance of the mansion turned muted, as grief replaced the sense of triumph that had once filled its rooms. Without Frederick's steady role, the company's leadership lost consistency. Day-to-day decisions that once carried firm direction grew more uncertain, and a pattern of drift began to set in. Management disagreements and uneven choices reflected this vacuum, weakening what had once been a unified operation. Competitors, especially the rapidly expanding Anheuser-Busch, seized the opportunity to tighten their hold on the growing lager market, eroding the dominance the Lemps had built. The erosion extended into the practical core of the business. Attention to quality, which Frederick had guarded carefully, began to falter. Some batches failed to meet the old standards, while key distribution ties loosened as relationships with suppliers and sellers were neglected. The brewery that once embodied precision and strength began to take on a more fractured identity, its once reliable image slipping in the eyes of customers and business partners. Inside the mansion, William Sr.'s grief deepened further. Family histories and staff accounts suggest that he ordered unnecessary alterations to the underground tunnels, creating new passages while sealing off old ones others for reasons no one fully understood. Workers reported sightings of him wandering the caves late at night, a story repeated ever since in tales of the mansion's decline. These behaviors became part of the family's lore, echoing the mix of mystery and sadness that came to define their legacy. By 1904, William Sr.'s decline reached its end when he died by a self-inflicted gunshot inside the mansion. His death not only confirmed the devastating toll of Frederick's absence, but also left the brewery with no clear hand at the helm. As the company faltered, larger forces in the outside world would soon add to the family's despair, forcing the empire into even greater peril. The arrival of national prohibition delivered the final and most devastating blow to the Lemp family enterprise. As the temperance movement gained momentum in the 1910s, and Congress edged closer to a nationwide alcohol ban, the family realized their entire business model was about to collapse. Brewing, which had sustained their wealth and defined their identity, was about to be outlawed. Confronted with this legal and political reality, the Lemps moved to liquidate key assets. Among the most painful was the sale of the Falstaff trademark, once their crown jewel, which was sold for only $25,000, far below its long-term value. Investors who purchased it understood that if prohibition were ever repealed, the brand could rise again. For the Lemp family, the sale severed their association with the very name that had once symbolized their dominance in American brewing. The brewery complex itself, once valued among the city's largest industrial sites, soon followed. At auction, the sprawling enterprise fetched just $588,000, a fraction of its former worth and less than the value of its equipment alone. The copper kettles were stripped out, bottling lines dismantled, and fermentation tanks hauled away as scrap. What remained were empty shell buildings and abandoned caves, once the beating heart of lager brewing in St. Louis, now reduced to silence. The collapse of the enterprise rippled through the family's personal fortune. Trusts and accounts tied to brewery profits quickly evaporated, leaving heirs with only fragments of the wealth that had supported their lives of luxury. Within the mansion, rooms once filled with imported furnishings and curated art became reminders of decline rather than symbols of grandeur. Arguments broke out over what remained of the assets, each discussion colored by the knowledge that recovery was impossible. The fallout extended well beyond the family mansion. Hundreds of workers who had relied on the brewery's steady wages found themselves without jobs, their craft and skills no longer of use in a nation that had outlawed their trade. Generations of brewmasters and laborers, once tied closely to the Lemp name, scattered as St. Louis's brewing power shifted decisively to surviving competitors. What had once been a thriving community around the brewery disintegrated almost overnight. Beneath the earth, the tunnels that had connected mansion to brewery became little more than hollow corridors. The limestone chambers sat dark and unused, their legendary coolness wasted on air instead of lager. Over time, these passages became loaded with symbolism, the gates of hell no longer guarding precious barrels, but standing as empty reminders of loss and decay. It was in this atmosphere of collapse, isolation, and silence that the family's tragedies deepened, shaping a grim legacy inside the walls of the mansion itself. The darkest pattern in the Lemp family history began not with financial failure, but with a death inside their own home. In 1904, William J. Lemp Sr., still grieving the earlier loss of his son Frederick and retreating from the brewery's affairs, took his own life with a revolver in his office at the mansion. The very room where he had commanded one of the largest brewing enterprises in the nation became the place where he ended his life. His death marked the first in a series of family tragedies that would unfold over the following decades. 16 years later, in 1920, his daughter Elsa Lemp Wright also died by suicide. Although she lived separately from the mansion and had married into wealth, her personal life was strained, and she had recently endured marital difficulties. Reports confirm that she died by a self-inflicted gunshot in her own home, making her the second member of the family to meet such an end. Her death occurred against the backdrop of Prohibition, which had already dismantled the family's financial foundation. Only 2 years after Elsa, in 1922, William J. Lemp Jr. continued the tragic sequence. By then, the brewery had been sold off, the Falstaff name severed from the family, and the last remnants of their empire dissolved. Surrounded by the mansion's fading grandeur, William Jr. died by a self-inflicted gunshot inside the house itself, underscoring how quickly decline had overtaken both the business and the family. His death reinforced the growing perception that the mansion was no longer a symbol of prosperity, but a setting for despair. The cycle concluded in 1949 with Charles Lemp, the last heir still living in the mansion. Charles had lived in seclusion for years, rarely engaging with the outside world. On that final day, he shot his beloved dog before turning the gun on himself, ensuring that nothing he valued would remain behind. His death closed not only the chapter of family residence in the mansion, but also the possibility of recovery from nearly half a century of decline. Taken together, these four deaths, 1904, 1920, 1922, and 1949, formed a devastating pattern. Each occurred under different circumstances, but all reflected a family weighed down by isolation, loss, and turmoil. Because several took place within the mansion itself, the building became inseparable from the sequence, its rooms and hallways permanently tied to the memory of tragedy. For many, the concentration of loss gave the house and its underground spaces a reputation that extended beyond history into legend, a reputation that grew even stronger in the shadow of what lay beneath it. The basement entrance that once linked the family mansion to the brewery caves became known among workers as the Gates of Hell. The heavy wooden door leading into the limestone tunnels already carried a feeling of unease, but repeated stories of unsettling experiences gave the name staying power. After the brewery shut down, the entrance remained a focal point in local folklore, described as a threshold where ordinary rules of sound and light seemed to falter. Accounts from workers described how the threshold appeared to absorb sound and swallow light. Flashlights aimed down the passage often seemed to dim, their beams unable to cut far into the darkness. Those standing at the door frequently said mansion noises behind them fell away at the boundary, leaving only a silence that pressed in heavier than still air. This mix of unnatural quiet and failing light left many with the impression of facing something alive in the void. Reports also spoke of sudden cold spots lingering near the entrance, with air shifts that could not be explained by drafts. Workers claimed to feel watched from the darkness, sometimes experiencing brushes against their arms when no one else was present. Footsteps echoing ahead in vacant tunnels and the sense of movement just beyond reach became regular stories among those who worked in or near the caves. To manage this charged space, staff developed small rituals, touching the doorframe for luck or refusing to linger near the threshold at all. The entrance gathered heavier connotations as family misfortunes deepened. William Sr. had used the tunnels regularly before his decline and suicide, and workers spoke of his presence lingering in the basement passage. Later family deaths, especially those inside the mansion, were said to intensify the atmosphere near the gates. Reports after each tragedy noted an uptick in activity, as though the structure itself retained the emotional residue of the events above. In the modern era, paranormal investigators emphasized that they consistently recorded unusual activity near this location. Workers and later visitors reported flashlights dimming at the threshold, sudden cold spots, and electronic voice phenomena suggesting faint whispers or voices from deeper within the passage. Some tours have repeated claims of recordings that seem to capture a child's voice saying, "Help me," in that space, though these remain accounts rather than verified proof. Through these testimonies, the gates of hell grew into one of the most recognized focal points of the mansion's haunted reputation. The stories surrounding the tunnels are steeped in unease, yet not every haunting tied to this house centers in darkness. Some speak of a presence connected not to shadows below, but to color, fragrance, and memory within the mansion's upper rooms. Among the stories tied to the Lemp Mansion, few are as distinctive as those surrounding Lillian Handlin Lemp, remembered by many as the Lavender Lady. Known across St. Louis for her obsession with the color, she incorporated lavender into nearly every part of her life. During her marriage to William Lemp Jr., her flair became a citywide spectacle. Her carriages rolled through the streets in shades of lavender, the harnesses dyed to match, and even the horses tinted with a faint lavender hue. She cultivated a public image that was impossible to ignore, ensuring that her style and presence became inseparable from the Lemp name. Inside the mansion, Lillian's mark remains strong. Many guests today say they catch a sudden whiff of lavender in empty rooms near her former bedroom or around her portrait, an anecdote repeated frequently in tour accounts and staff reports. The scent is described as abrupt and concentrated, as though someone wearing heavy perfume had just left the room moments before. It lingers briefly, then dissipates without explanation. For many who encounter it, the fragrance is powerful enough to stop conversation, leaving little doubt that something unusual has brushed past. Her portrait, still displayed within the mansion, carries its own set of associations. Visitors have reported sudden cold spots forming around the painting. These cold patches often seem to gather only at this location, defying the even climate in the rest of the house. Some guides mention that staff members notice the portrait draws attention repeatedly during nighttime tours, as if her presence remains tied most strongly to her likeness. The consistency of these reports, across decades, has helped elevate the Lavender Lady from eccentric figure to enduring presence. Sightings add to the legend. Several guests describe catching glimpses of a woman in a lavender gown moving silently across rooms or gliding down the staircase where Lillian once made her dramatic entrances. Witnesses often note how quickly the figure vanishes, disappearing before they can follow. When the vision and fragrance occur together, lavender perfume in the air followed by a fleeting glimpse of her gown, the effect leaves onlookers convinced that they have encountered the lady herself rather than an echo of the past. Lillian's reputation extended beyond fashion. Her name once filled headlines during her 1908 divorce trial, a scandal that made her personal life as public as her horses and gowns. That same notoriety, combined with her bold persona, seems to have lingered in the spaces she occupied, creating a haunting not of tragedy, but of presence. Those who walk the mansion's upper rooms often leave with the impression that she never completely departed, that her sense of identity itself imprinted on the house. Yet while the Lavender Lady remains tied to beauty and recognition, stories told about rooms only a floor above speak of something far more unsettling. The attic of the Lemp Mansion carries one of its most persistent and unsettling legends. According to long-circulated stories, William Lemp Jr. fathered an illegitimate child who was concealed in the upper floors. Folklore claims the child had unusual facial features, leading staff and locals to spread the nickname Monkey Face Boy. Accounts described him as hidden away in the attic, though details about his condition shift widely depending on the telling. What remains consistent is the absence of any historical confirmation. No records, birth, medical, or otherwise, support the story, which survives entirely through staff recollections, oral tradition, and later retellings. Despite this lack of documentation, the attic windows became focal points for those who lived in or visited the house. Tenants occupying the mansion during years it was rented out repeatedly reported catching sight of a child's face staring down from the highest windows. These incidents occurred during periods when no children lived in the building, and witnesses described the figure as appearing suddenly at the glass before vanishing. The similarity of these sightings across different residents over time gave weight to the legend, even as factual grounding remained absent. Investigations in recent decades have added further layers to the mystery. Paranormal groups frequently identify the attic as the most active part of the mansion, citing recordings of faint childlike voices. In some cases, electronic voice phenomena have captured sounds that researchers interpret as saying the name Zeke, a detail they connect to the hidden child accounts. Unexplained knocks, shifts in temperature, and equipment malfunctions are reported more often here than elsewhere in the house. These phenomena remain subjective, but their repetition across investigations has helped the attic maintain its reputation as a center of activity. Other reports suggest that more than one childlike presence may inhabit the attic and surrounding rooms. Witnesses describe hearing small footsteps running along the floorboards above them, laughter echoing from empty spaces, and toys left in the rooms gradually shifting position without clear cause. The clustering of these occurrences suggests a different tone from the adult presences often described elsewhere in the mansion, reinforcing the idea that the upper levels hold a separate, more specific energy. Whether rooted in fact or purely a sustained legend, the story of the hidden child exemplifies how folklore takes hold where records fall silent. The attic offers no official proof of the figure's existence, yet accounts of strange sights, sounds, and sensations persist through decades of testimony. It is this blending of rumor, unexplained phenomena, and absence of verifiable history that keeps the story alive. And it is within these gaps, what was never documented and what was allowed to fade, that the mansion's mysteries find their most fertile ground. Edwin Lemp, the last of the family line, made a decision that would reshape how future generations would remember the Lemps. Unlike his relatives, whose lives ended in highly visible tragedies, Edwin acted with careful intent. He instructed his executors to destroy paintings, correspondence, and household artifacts that had accumulated over decades. This was not routine estate management. It was a deliberate purge meant to erase a family identity that Edwin believed carried a curse. By removing every trace he could, he hoped to sever the weight of history itself. What followed was the loss of priceless materials that might have illuminated both achievement and decline. Portraits that had hung across the mansion's walls were burned, leaving no likenesses to anchor the people who once lived there. Private letters and business papers were consigned to fire, silencing voices that could have explained choices made at the brewery and inside the home. Brewing recipes and technical notes, documents that would have provided firsthand evidence of the family's role in shaping American beer, were also destroyed. In a single directive, Edwin created permanent absences that history could never repair. The irony of this act is that it multiplied fascination instead of extinguishing it. Without the records, speculation filled the vacuum with stories blending memory, rumor, and invention. What might have been clarified by paper trails instead became the subject of endless questioning. Why destroy such evidence? What truths were hidden among those flames? Each lost letter and vanished recipe deepened curiosity, reinforcing the idea that the family's past carried more mystery than fact. Only the mansion itself escaped. Its stone walls and sheer bulk made demolition impractical, forcing Edwin to settle for erasing its contents rather than the structure. Yet the survival of that physical shell ensured that absence would feel even sharper. Visitors walking through its bare room sensed the deliberate removal, the hallways standing as hollow reminders where full histories should have remained. The empty spaces became symbols of erasure, prompting imagination to supply its own stories in the gaps left behind. Today, what endures are fragments, details spared from Edwin's purge, pieces introduced from outside, and the building itself. This incomplete record has transformed the mansion into a puzzle, with each missing piece inviting invented answers. Historians, locals, and visitors continue to layer folklore on top of fact, while paranormal accounts often step into the silence left by what is gone. By seeking to end the story, Edwin may only have ensured it would never fade. The space he left behind continues to draw interest, not simply as a relic of the past, but as a place where absence has become its own presence. And it is in that charged emptiness that people still come, not only to see what remains, but to experience for themselves what refuses to be erased. Today, the mansion functions not only as a restaurant and inn, but also as a site that welcomes investigation, turning its historic rooms into what many describe as a modern haunted laboratory. Visitors come as guests, researchers, or curious onlookers, and their reports build a continuing record of unexplained activity that stretches across decades. The building now serves a dual purpose, preserving the past as a piece of St. Louis history while offering investigators a chance to test accounts of the supernatural with present-day tools. One of the most common phenomena involves the doors throughout the mansion. Witnesses describe heavy wooden doors opening and closing on their own, despite solid latches and flat floors. Investigators often leave equipment in one room only to discover it moved to another hours later. Cameras, recording devices, and EMF meters have all been found displaced, sometimes in spaces already swept thoroughly before. These events feel less like accidents of human error and more like deliberate intrusions into the process of observation itself. The original piano in the dining area presents another irregular occurrence. Staff and visitors alike recount hearing notes ring out in empty rooms, the sound carrying through corridors after hours. The instrument requires pressure on its keys to produce sound, yet melodies sometimes form without anyone present. Most often, this takes place in the very chamber that once hosted the Lemp family's elaborate dinners and gatherings, as though echoes of music from the past resurface in moments beyond explanation. To examine conditions systematically, investigators employ tools ranging from thermal cameras to motion sensors. Sudden temperature drops have been logged, with readings plunging in seconds, especially in spaces tied to documented tragedies. Electronic voice phenomena recordings frequently capture faint whispers that appear to respond to questions in real time. Full-spectrum cameras have produced images showing dark shapes moving across hallways that correspond to witness accounts. Though open to interpretation, these layers of documentation add structure to reports already circulating for decades. Tour groups often experience phenomena firsthand, independent of prior knowledge. Many first-time visitors describe footsteps in vacant halls or the intense sense of being watched even before guides explain the building's reputation. These accounts match those of long-term staff, whose daily routines are marked by similar incidents. The consistency across so many different observers has made the mansion a rare case where folklore and modern testimony overlap almost seamlessly. Together, testimonies and the tools of modern investigation suggest the building preserves more than memory. The mansion operates as a place where history and phenomenon remain intertwined, sustaining accounts of the past long after the family themselves disappeared. The persistence of these experiences reminds us that some structures continue to bear the traces of lives once lived within them, shaping how they are understood in the present. The Lemp Mansion now stands as both a preserved landmark and a reminder of how quickly power can vanish. Its story stretches from a brewing dynasty that once shaped an industry to a household remembered for silence, loss, and unanswered questions. The limestone caves that secured the family's fortune later became bound to their decline, with the same dark passages that stored barrels of beer now tied to legends of lingering spirits. Visitors today can view the surviving photographs and artifacts that escaped destruction, forming their own impressions of what remains within the house and what may still move unseen. The mansion's legacy continues to evolve through guided tours, personal experiences, and countless investigations. History, rumor, and testimony blend together into a narrative that refuses final explanation, leaving each visitor to decide whether they encounter a haunted house, a preserved ruin, or the echo of an empire long past. This has been Midnight Signals. I'm Russ Chamberlain, guiding you through the shadows where history meets mystery. Until next time, stay vigilant, seek the hidden, and remember, in every silence there is a signal, and in every signal, a story waiting to be told.